How you doing? And welcome to the third edition of Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi. I'm your host for tonight. I'm a retired FBI supervisory special agent and profiler. I worked in the FBI for 22 years. Before that, I was a prosecutor in New York City. Today, I'm with Laura Richards and Lisa Zambetti.
Hey.
Talking about making a murderer. And at this point, we're going to focus on Brendan Dassey, the case against him, his trial, his conviction, and what should have happened. All right, well, let's get right into it.
Right.
But it's a good, this is a good time to actually talk about Brendan Dassey and how he related to the Steve Avery case.
So, Jim, before Brendan came on in the documentary, what were your thoughts about?
Well, clearly I had a lot of issues with the police behavior and the prosecutor's behavior. I think, at that point, the prosecutor really wasn't involved. It was mostly with the police behavior and the fact that they had a conflict of interest, a very obvious, stated conflict of interest. They set a bunch of rules that they were not going to be involved, that the people involved in this and the law enforcement agency involved in this, as well as the prosecutor's office involved in the original false conviction of Steve Avery, would not be involved in the investigation. They broke those rules. They violated them up and down, and I have never in my entire history of law enforcement, and this is over 35 years now, I have never once heard of somebody doing a search, a law enforcement official doing a search with another law enforcement official watching that person to make sure they weren't doing something wrong. Why on earth would you do that? If it was possible that they would do something wrong in that search, they should never have stepped foot on that property.
Right.
I don't understand why it happened.
I was
really worried about that. That was a problem. However, on the other hand, there's a tremendous amount of evidence found on that property. And even without the key, which was found in Steve Avery's home, there's still a tremendous amount of evidence that points towards him. The fact that he was last seen with this victim, the fact that he had called her a number of times, the fact that he had his burn pit was filled with her bones and bones fragments representing the majority of the bones in her body, not just a couple of random ones that somebody could have tossed there, that there was a tremendous amount of information that pointed to his guilt. However, I don't think that he got a fair trial. And it's not because of those officers being involved. It's because of what the district attorney did after Brendan Dassey was interviewed.
Okay, so shall we turn to the case of Brendan?
Yeah, I mean, I'll add to that. I thought you had just asked the question about Brendan Dassey. So, you know, what I wanted to check when we're talking about what initial reaction we had was my first notes, actually, because, you know, there's some interesting things that you learn along the way, not necessarily just from the documentary, but by looking at other evidence, so which has changed my view on what's going on. But I certainly, you know, initially from watching the documentary and knowing about, you know, in terms of the Avery Task Force, the Avery Law that was coming in, that he's getting his life back together, and then you see, you know, a number of people being deposed and then him being rearrested. And of course, we know that some of the problems they try and put straight up front, you know, the problem with Avery's background, but certainly you're given information about Avery being arrested and being interviewed without a lawyer and nobody knowing he's there. And, you know, I'm going back to my notes and thinking, you know, well, was he allowed a lawyer? You know, how did these things happen? You know, you think it's something that would just almost be impossible, not just one thing, but multiple things that they're getting so wrong, you know, and the conflict of interest, those investigators, as Jim said, back on the property. Certainly, you know, all of those question marks, the blood vial, everything seems to point to the fact that there are at least a number of officers that are certainly out to get Avery and to make sure that he will be found guilty for this crime. And then when you lay it in terms of the prosecutor or the district attorney, Ken Kratz, who decides to hold a press conference before the trial. So again, poisoning the jury, the potential juror pool. You know, there were just things that I was writing down of how is this even possible? How's it even happening? But I certainly felt on the balance of everything that I'd heard from the Netflix documentary that there was very clearly, at best, police incompetence, but at worst, you know, a number of people had colluded to make absolutely sure that he was found guilty, which he was. And of course, Brendan's evidence, because his statement was the last piece of evidence, I guess, that was clearly implicating Stephen Avery. And of course, when you hear all of that, you know, for me, it was too, I was outraged for the two of them, but for different reasons. So when you see the way that Brendan's treated, you know, and again, that's the thing I think people feel incredibly frustrated and angry about, that sense of real injustice of seeing somebody manipulated in that way, that we know that ultimately, the only thing in Brendan's particular case, the only thing really found against him is his own confession, right, which we're going to come on to in terms of how that confession came about.
Right.
So I think at the conclusion of the documentary, I was fairly convinced that there had been police misconduct. And at the very least, there was police incompetence, not following their own rules about being conflicted out. That was a major problem and should have created a problem in terms of the prosecution. But there were some things that still bothered me about the location of the evidence and the kind of evidence that was found. And I really didn't understand at that point what the theories were. I mean, when we're talking about the case against Stephen Avery, there were certain things that he was charged with that were later dropped.
Right.
And those were all based on Brendan Dassey's, quote, confession. That's really sort of a branch of this investigation that went horribly wrong, that is not only filled with incompetency, but filled with an example, of the perfect example of how even if you don't intend to, you can get a false confession by employing means that would be absolutely legitimate with normal people. But if you employ those same means with somebody who's underage, who's easily manipulated, who has a low IQ, who's in special education, somebody who doesn't really understand and who wants to please the police,
right,
that you can actually get a full false confession that is 100% absolutely false. So I think we ought to talk about Brendan Dassey at this point.
We should. And I have questions about if that false confession in your mind, is it intentional or is it just part of the procedure that you go down that rabbit hole? Or,
well, I think that that's something we need to discuss in great detail because Laura and I both have listened to the full.
You have?
Wait, videotaped confession.
Okay.
We weren't able to find the audio tape confession that preceded the first videotape confession. Huh. There's only pieces of that are played in the actual documentary. But, and I'll have this little caveat, if they did not suggest the information about the garage to Brendan Dassey, then I think we look at what we're looking at when we're looking at whether or not a statement is truthful, when we're looking at an interrogation, is we look for a free narrative. And that is something that is indicative of truth-telling. Something that has details about other sensory information, about what's going on emotionally, about what's where people are spatially, other smells and sights and sounds, things like that help to improve the likelihood that that's a truthful statement. The only time that Brendan Dassey, in the entire four-hour interrogation that was actually videotaped, the only time that he gave a free narrative was in the first few minutes, not initially, but a few minutes into it, he gave a statement about having been called by Steve Avery late at night, around 6:30 or 7 p.m., and he went over there to help him do something in his garage. And Brendan talks about going there, and at first he says that it was Steve Avery's car in the garage, but then he says, no, it was actually Teresa Hulbach's car. And that Steve opened the back and showed him the body of Teresa in the back of the car. Her body was covered by a small blanket, in part. She had been stabbed in the abdomen, and that Stephen asked him to help him carry the body onto the fire. Mm-hmm. That they used one of those dollies that you roll under a car with to get the body over to the fire pit, and they threw her body on the fire pit. And he said, that's the entirety of what I did and what I was involved in.
So when you say free narrative, he said that section with no encouragement, no sentences,
in a row, no prompting. And again, I'm only caveating that is I didn't hear the entire audio recorded interrogation that happened before this. If all that was suggested to him before, then this completely invalidates what I'm saying about this now.
Got it.
But of all the statements that came out of Brendan Dassey in that four-hour videotaped interrogation, that is the only one that rings truthful to me. And on top of that, I see hundreds of instances during that 4 hours where the police suggested the answers to him or encouraged him to guess from A to B to C to D before they said, okay, that's good. Now you got it right. Every other time they're saying, you're lying, and they're saying, what else happened? What else did you see? What else was going on? What else did he do?
Right.
And he clearly is guessing.
I mean, certainly this was the game changer for me. Not having watched the documentary, this particular piece of footage wasn't shown on the show, but it was the game changer where on the same day I watch the full interview, and it's a free recall, as Jim said. And, you know, I turned to Jim and I said, you need to listen to this, because this first bit just seems absolutely the truthful account of what's gone on. And of course, we don't hear any of that again later on, but just the detail of what he says. And when you put it in the context that we know that he was cleaning up, that he did have bleach on his jeans, it would absolutely make sense. And thereafter, his account completely changes when he's being led. You know, and he does say to his mum, well, you know, I just guessed it all, like I do my homework. And that sounds very believable.
Absolutely believable.
Yeah.
That he would say something like that. So, you know, there's so much said about Brendan Dassey and, you know, his vulnerability and his suggestibility, and he's trying to give them the answers that he thinks that they want. And that's why, you know, the account changes there on out. And in particular, when he's with the investigator who sat there saying, you did rape her, didn't you? Draw a picture of
that was,
it
that
here.
That was infuriating.
That's a whole other level.
But why I'm saying that, actually, Jim, is because it's quite important to put it in the context of, you know, the free recall that he starts off with. And then, you know, when we ask a question, so what does a false confession look like? Well, you know, this is exactly what it looks like, actually. It's a pretty textbook case in terms of, you know, what goes on and across time. In terms of Brendan Dassey's account, which we know clearly didn't happen, in terms of the way that he then goes on to draw these pictures, and certainly he's using some images as well, that he's free call from movies that he's watched, etc. But the first hour of that particular statement that he gives, where he's just there thinking that he's helping the police, he's told that he's a witness, there's no appropriate adult with him, and it's a very relaxed environment.
Is that unusual that a minor wouldn't have their parent in there?
Well, in the United States of America, if you're a minor and you're being interviewed, the parents should have the option of being there with the police when they interview or interrogate the child. Obviously, if he's a suspect, he also has a right to counsel. So it's not absolutely unusual, but in this case, the mother claims, at least, that she was not permitted to come in. That would be a violation of his rights, and that would mean that anything that was said could not be used against him.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean it couldn't be used against somebody else, but what's instructive in this case is that Brendan Dassey, when he gave that confession, that resulted in three additional charges being levied against Steve Avery. Although he was charged with those things, And the DA would do a very public, open statement telling all the gory details of those things, which we'll get back to because mm-hmm. that was outrageous conduct.
Mm-hmm.
But none of those charges were actually proven in a court of law. The DA had to withdraw all those charges against Steve Avery. Why was that? Because there was no evidence of any of mm-hmm. that. None of the forensic evidence and none of the other testimonial evidence and Brendan Dassey's own evidence did not come in that trial. What does that tell you? There wasn't a level of confidence about that evidence. Yet, even though they didn't charge or convict Stephen Avery of any of the things that Brendan Dassey said he did, they still charged and convicted Brendan Dassey of those things. It makes absolutely no sense.
And the prosecutor never re-narrated then without Brendan's...
Correct.
You know what I mean? How do they, you know?
It's a strange anomaly, and I don't understand how they got away with doing it. But when you listen, as Laura was saying about Brendan Dassey guessing, when you listen to the actual transcript, this is the audio transcript, the audio recording, and I think it was an inaccurate transcript because they were saying, come on, you must have seen something of her in the fire because mm-hmm. the pit was no bigger than this table sitting in front of us. And they kept asking him, and they said he was lying when he said, I don't know, I don't know, I know, I didn't see anything, I didn't see anything. And eventually they said, what did you see? What did you see? What did you see?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, toes?
Yeah.
And you could hear the inflection going up at the end, like
right.
he was guessing.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, okay, now you're doing good. And what else did you see? And then
right.
he started adding things.
So he's just trying to get out of there.
You know? He's trying to be helpful.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But he also wants to go back to school,
yes,
doesn't he?
He does. He says, can I get back because I have a sixth period project due? But then it gets worse. And they're getting specific. Okay, tell me what you did to her head. What else was done to her head? And again, he said, cut her hair. And they're like, okay, great, good, good, that's great. Now, what else did you do? Punched her. You could see that they're clearly not happy with this answer. And they're like, all right, what else did you do? And they said, you know, and he said, cut her. And they said, kept going, come on, you're not telling us the whole truth. You got to tell us what happened. Come on.
Cut her where? You know, and constantly asking the detail.
But then he said, all right, I'm just going to come out and ask you, who shot her in the head?
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah.
And that is the most, direct violation that they made during the entire interrogation. You'd never suggest that kind of information. Clearly, that was not known to the public. Clearly, that was something that was only found in a very, very minute forensic detail. And they should have kept that secret so that they could determine whether or not he was actually involved in the crime.
Right.
Because they gave him that, they violated every rule that we teach about interrogations, and they prevented themselves from finding out whether or not Brendan was giving a false confession. Clearly, he was giving a false confession. Clearly, they fed him this information, and he went with it. And that became the narrative from that point on with the district attorney. And I think that is actually why Brendan did not get a fair trial at all. Brendan should absolutely not be in jail right now. He should definitely have that conviction overturned because of it.
Yeah.
And he had no idea, you know, it wasn't just what he was saying, but it was the context that he was saying it in. You know, like I said before, he was saying, you know, and can I go back to school now? You know, and he's asking the time because he's got somewhere that he needs to be. He's got no idea he's about to be arrested.
And even when they say, we're going to have to arrest you because of what you told us, and he said, what, for a day?
I don't mean to laugh, but it's
his level of understanding.
Yes.
He didn't understand what was going on. And he asked his mother, am I going to be able to get out for WrestleMania?
Right,
you know,
right.
That kind of stuff.
But don't those eight, they're agents, right? Are they detectives? I can't remember who was.
I think they were detectives from the neighboring county.
But aren't they realizing that the more things they lead him to say, we cut her hair, we did this, they have to then find that evidence. I mean, if he's saying all these things, that just adds to the burden that they have to find the hair. They have to find all these things, and they never do.
That's what you would think. And, of course, they find absolutely no evidence to corroborate what Brendan Dassey said.
Right.
I watched the documentary and saw that trial. The trial against Brendan Dassey. And I didn't see them. Now, it's possible that the the documentary did not put in all the evidence against Brendan Dassey, but I didn't see a single piece of corroborating evidence at all. Not a single thing. The letter that supposedly he got from the mailbox on that day and had to hand deliver to Steve Avery. Where's that letter?
Right.
Where did that come from? Why didn't they find that? I mean, it should have been either in his garage or it was sent out from somebody somewhere. Why wasn't it found? I mean, all they have to do is get all his bills and backtrack. Well, right. Who's going to send a bill to him that would arrive on Halloween that
right.
year?
Right.
Did they do any of that evidence? Did they do a trash cover? Did they dig through his garbage and find out what was thrown out? I don't think so. And I think all that stuff, I mean, if they had found one piece of that, it would have gone a tremendous distance in terms of proving the case against Brendan Dassey. But they didn't find anything.
Unless you have something to add to that, Laura, I want to ask you about another witness.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, without any evidence, you know, and they don't actually have any evidence that puts him there, you know, the only thing that they do have for a case is that confession. So you take the confession away, you know, as Jim says, and actually there is no case against Brendan Dassey at all. And I think Ken Kratz said it throughout the Avery trial. I think I counted, he said it 5 times. You know, there was only one man who killed Teresa Holbach, and that's Stephen Avery. So it's really interesting that then, you know, a year later they have the trial for Brendan Dassey when he makes a very clear case the whole way through. There's only one person that's killed her.
Right.
How do they not throw
the
that
prosecutors
back at him?
Are actually allowed to if they're separate, if they separate the trials, they're allowed to argue inconsistently, but I think it's unconscionable. Mm-hmm. I think he knew that mm-hmm. was not the case. But when the investigators are talking to Brendan Dassey, they said a number of times, "We're on your side. I'm thinking you're all right. You don't have to worry about things. Stephen is starting to talk. Stephen mm-hmm. is going to lay some crap on you." Now, that's exactly mm-hmm. the kinds of things that were used in the Central Park jogger case and the West Memphis 3 case, where in those cases they told individual underage guys mm-hmm. that their co-defendants were
saying, ratting on them. Yeah,
you did it. Okay. By using that technique on somebody who is mentally challenged, you're almost guaranteed to get a false confession. Mm-hmm. They should have known this. As you were bringing up earlier, Lisa, you said, don't they have a responsibility at that point to dig down and find corroborating evidence? They did have that responsibility. They also had a responsibility in that room to determine whether or not Brendan Dassey was capable of actually telling them a true narrative. What they should have done is spent an hour or 2 hours with him talking about his daily life. Find out what he could recount. Find out if they could manipulate him into saying that, you know, the bus driver drove off the road that day. I mean, come on, we saw the tire tracks. You must have driven off. And if he said, yeah, okay, well, then they know that he's easily manipulated.
Right.
They should have done tests like that because they should have been aware, based on his demeanor, based on his request to go back to school by 129, all those things.
Oh, yeah, they're
been
just ignoring that. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Red flags that popped up that gave them an indication. Now, maybe they weren't trained well enough. Maybe they never had that school, and maybe they really didn't know what they were doing. But either way, that's either incompetence or deliberate blind eye to something that was happening right in front of them, and it created a false confession mm-hmm. that was then used to convict him, and in a way, in the general public, to convict Stephen Avery.
Right.
And we had a case very similar to this of it was a young girl called Leslie Molseed who was murdered, and someone called Stefan Kizko was actually arrested for it, and he was questioned over 2 days with no lawyer. He was very vulnerable, and he was learning disabled as well, very low IQ, and he confesses after 2 days. He did say a number of times that he was being bullied by the investigators. Mm. It was a very sad case. He was found not to have committed it, and, you know, his conviction, we don't call it, was vacated, but he was certainly exonerated. Mm-hmm. When DNA came a DNA result showed that it was somebody called Ronald Castree. But actually in 1992, we then brought in a whole new process called PEACE, which ensures that investigators prepare and plan and evaluate information, but that they don't give information to the person that they're questioning. And they certainly allow that person to give free recall. And they ask them to tell the story many times over, because if you're lying, you get cognitive load. Mm. And
what
so,
does that mean?
So cognitive load just means it's really hard work to maintain a lie. Mm. So, you know, when you're having to maintain a lie, you're having to work quite hard. Mm. So, you know, we'd ask the person that's being questioned to tell a story, to tell it, the account in a different way, maybe tell it backwards. You know, tell the story over and over, and then look for consistencies and inconsistencies. But both those, that was 1992, bear in mind. So it changed our whole system. And of course, we're going to go on to, you know, for me, there's bigger picture things at play here, because it's not just about this one case. It's actually about how you improve the system, that there are clear rules and regulations in place, but you've still got, you know, some areas who are not playing ball, and there are clear violations that are happening. So we'll probably talk about that later on in terms of sort of the lessons to be learned here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think if people out there want to help prevent this from happening again and help really improve the process, we should be dealing with PEACE here. We should
be... What does PEACE stand for?
So that's a good question, but I am going to tell you. I mean, like I said, it came in 1992, so that was off the back of numerous miscarriages of justice and false confessions. So, you know, exactly the reason why the system was changed and improved upon. So PEACE is sort of the planning and preparation that the officers have to do before they go into interview. Then engagement, so engaging with the person that you're questioning, explaining, making it very clear to them why they're there and what the process will be, letting that person give an account and a free flow account, and asking open questions, not closed questions.
Free narrative.
Free narrative, which is really important. Closure and then evaluation. So all of the officers within the various police forces within England and Wales, and there are 42 of them, are all PEACE trained. We don't have interrogation, incidentally. Ours are interviews. And of
They're
course,
much more polite in the UK.
We are indeed. But, you know, and the officers will be looking for consistencies, inconsistencies. Somebody else will be listening to the interview as well. So, you know, they'll be looking for, you know, where somebody's working hard, the cognitive load, mm-hmm. as it's called, mm-hmm. where because lies are very difficult to maintain. So, you know, and again, they can't tell untruths. They can't give misinformation or disinformation.
That's something that in the United States we're still allowed to do. Detectives, investigating officers, when they're interrogating somebody, are allowed to a point to actually give false information. Hmm. They can only do that to a point, though. They can't say that, well, we have your DNA, this FBI report that says your DNA was actually at the crime scene or on the murder weapon. They can't make up documentary or physical evidence. What they can do is imply it, though. They can say, what's going to happen? We have somebody searching the car right now. What's going to happen when they find the victim's DNA in your car? Mm-hmm. How are you going to explain that? They can do things like that. They can mislead to a certain extent. Not when you're dealing with a young, underage kid who is in special education, who is low functioning, has a very low IQ, mm-hmm. and is easily manipulated. That is not a time when you can use any kind of manipulation at all, or you shouldn't be able to use any kind of manipulation at all, because you're basically guaranteed to get a false confession if you do it under those circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fundamental difference. Our investigators can't bluff, lie, or coerce. But like you said, Jim, you know, when you're talking about young and vulnerable, you know, teenagers, then you have to have an appropriate adult present. You know, you have to give them a lawyer as well, or a write to a lawyer and explain things properly. But the UK system, you know, is slightly different, because, like I said, from our miscarriages of justice, and we did have many, you know, across, well, prior to the 90s, and in 1992, we changed the whole system to try and minimise the amount of cases where this can happen.
Mm. Okay, so I wanted to ask you, especially Laura, because I know that you, I think you might have some interesting insight into this. So we saw the whole reason that they got onto the trail of Brendan, it seems to me, is they heard this rumor through his cousin, Kayla, that they that kind of led them to him, mm-hmm. in some way, that she had repeated a story after a party.
She went to a guidance counselor at school.
She did, yeah. And she repeated a story that rang some bells, and it led them to Brendan. So when you saw, she came to the stand later in his trial and testified that she had been making everything up. What did you think of her testimony?
Well, firstly, the show kind of gave you a context to that. The reason why Brendan came up seemed to also relate to the fact that they tried through Jodie to turn her almost against Stephen Avery. Mm. So there was that context that was given to the viewer, that they had spoken to Jodie a number of times and then they tried Brendan. Jodie says she doesn't want to talk to the investigators anymore. And lo and behold, they turn up at the school and want to question Brendan, although they say to him at that time that he's not a suspect, that he's a witness. So it's all very informal. But I think in terms of Kayla, there's certainly... was a suggestion that she had heard things that Brendan had said which implicated him in the murder. But when I watched her evidence, as it were, and she said that she had made that up, well, my first impression of her was that she also was quite vulnerable as a young person, but certainly what she was saying seemed to be true. So the truthful account when she's actually giving evidence, but there's real pressure, borne upon her in terms of, well, which is the truthful of, account, the first one or the second one. But I certainly felt that what she was saying, that she did make it up. Maybe she didn't understand the seriousness of what she was saying and that it was implicating Brendan. And, these were all things that maybe, she just enjoyed the attention at the time, but she had no real understanding about the consequences of what she was saying. Jim, what did you think?
Yeah, and I think when she was testifying and when the defense attorney brought up the document that memorialized the information that she had given to detectives earlier, you could see the blood rising in her face. You could start seeing the patches, the red patches, that she was under stress, and it looked like she was about to break into tears. And she did, in fact, break into tears. I think that was very genuine. I don't think that's... I would say almost certainly she could not have faked that. But it's just, what is the nature of why she was feeling that way? And I believe, based on what she said, that she did, in fact, make it up because she said, I was confused. And why would she have been confused? Well, it actually goes back to that same district attorney, Kratz, who made a public statement, a very public statement about these horrific things. He said that Brendan raped Teresa. He said that Brendan helped cut her throat, helped burn her body, helped do all these horrific things to her. So she was very upset with that. She thought her cousin had done this. And so maybe she just wanted, as Laura said, some attention. I mean, she was probably very distressed by this. This is her family. She wanted to separate herself from these evil people in her family. And so she made up a story to kind of bridge that gap, to make her feel like she's being part of the solution and not part of the problem. But clearly, when she was on that stand and she said, I made it all up, she did not exhibit any of the indicators that I would think that she was lying at that time. I think it was a very heartfelt and really emotional moment for her.
It was a very true account, and you could see that emotionally where she was, and being young and vulnerable, you could see, it was absolutely transparent. But I think the important thing about that press conference that you mentioned, Jim, was that that was actually pre-trial, wasn't it?
Yes.
Where the, Ken Kratz, the DA, decides to hold a press conference before the trial, which is absolutely incredulous. I mean, I've certainly never seen that before. I don't know if you have, Jim.
It's extremely rare. Prosecutors normally will not do it because then if they don't actually prove what they say in the press conference, it hurts their case. Also, most prosecutors care about not poisoning the jury pool. In this case, he did both of those things.
Right.
I mean, he violated the number one rule of an investigation, which is don't put out information while an investigation is going on that could then just come back to you reiterating what you're telling everybody. And that seems to be what happened
exactly
in the case of this young girl.
Exactly what happened with Kayla. I mean, certainly, in the UK, it's sub judice, but pre-trial, all the detail and information is sub judice. And sub judice, as in you cannot discuss it prior to it actually going to trial, the details of what's gone on.
And this is, she is not a sophisticated, mature woman. This is a 15-year-old girl. she doesn't have the sophistication level, I believe, right, to have gotten up on the stand and said, I am going to strategically withdraw the information and say that what I said was untrue, that I made it up. I don't believe that she had the sophistication to be able to do that. What she did was she broke it down in tears because she was caught in a lie earlier, that right, she had lied to the detectives because she had lied to her guidance counselor. She didn't really understand, as Laura said, the significance of what she was saying. But now, in a court of law, where she's swearing to tell the truth, she actually did tell the truth.
So I just want to share what it reminded me of is when I was 13, I witnessed a stabbing. Me and some of my, we were sitting in a pizza parlor, some of my friends, and an older kid who I'd never seen before walked into the pizza parlor and walked up to one of my friends and just stabbed him right in the throat.
Oh, my God. That.
And this kid I'd never seen run out, right? And so we're all in shock. And before the police can arrive, a lot of other kids kind of wander in and we're all milling about it. And the story is just, you know, being shared, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the cops arrive and they're like, okay, who can tell us what happened? And this girl who had not been there stepped up and said, this is what happened. And she recounted everything that she had not seen. And she knew who the guy was. I didn't know who the guy was, but she knew who he was. She knew why it had happened. She could describe the weapon, the whole thing. And I was, I'm 13. I don't know anything. You know, he asked, who can tell me what happened? And she was telling basically what I'd seen. And then finally the cop said, okay, miss, where were you sitting? And she's like, oh, I wasn't here. And I thought he was going to punch her in the face because, he'd wasted all that time. But I could see how quickly, just in a matter of 20 minutes.
Well, the first thing that cop did that was wrong was he didn't separate every one of the potential witnesses. Yeah. What you need to do is immediately separate all the witnesses. They should not be talking to each other about the story, mm-hmm, because what happens is they plant details in mm-hmm each other's minds. Mm-hmm. And somebody, our memory is not a digital recording of what went on. Our memory is stored in very different ways in our brains, and people perceive what they expect to perceive. Mm. And our brains, unfortunately, fill in details when it doesn't have the information. Yeah. So just recounting a memory, they think, can actually change that memory. So that cop made a major mistake right from the start. It's unfortunate because I hope that case wasn't destroyed because of those mistakes.
It wasn't. Then I ended up giving my testimony and I ended up testifying against the guy.
I mean, how traumatic for you as well, terms of that happening. And did he live or?
He did. We stuffed pizza napkins in the hole in his throat and he ended up surviving, but it was a miracle.
Wow.
It was
due to your quick thinking.
Well, anyway, it was just one of these anecdotes you kind of can't believe, but it speaks to me when I saw Kayla on the stand, that how, quickly
two and two can be five.
But another thing I'd like to talk about with respect to Brendan is the fact that when his defense attorney before he had even interviewed Brendan, made a public statement mm-hmm saying, while my client is morally and legally responsible for this murder, he was led there by pure evil.
Incredible,
Of course, he lied about it on the stand or forgotten that he had made that statement in public, but they played it back and showed that he was not being truthful when he said he never made that statement. But clearly, it shows that he was not actually legally defending his client. Mm. The next thing he did was get his investigator to get Brendan to confess to this crime and write out a confession. And I think during that time, Brendan actually, under the stress of this statement, either you're going to be sorry for what you did and tell me what you did, or I can't help you and you're going to end up spending the rest of your life in jail. Because of that, he said, okay, here's a form he put in front of him after spreading all these pictures of the victim and blue ribbons and all this other stuff. And he said, you have to check one of these boxes. I'm sorry for what I did, or I'm not sorry for what I did. Not, I didn't do anything.
Right.
Didn't even give him that option. And then he actually wrote a free narrative. Again, a good indication of truth when somebody gives a free narrative that is uninterrupted. Mm-hmm. And Brendan says in that thing that he was called late, he went over there, and he helped him with the fire. And he doesn't say anything else about Teresa or anything like that. And the guy looks at it and says, I can't use this. I can't help you. You're going to spend the rest of your life in jail. So then Brendan adds on details that he had told the police before when they had fed these details to him, he reiterated them back to him. And basically that became the basis of his now confirmed confession, which, of course, we still believe is false.
Mm. I mean, he pressured him continuously.
Right.
You know, it was blatant. It was very clear that's what was going on when he's saying, you know, draw a picture of you stabbing her here and draw a picture here of you having sex with her and draw a picture here of her being tied to the bed. You know, he made very clear statements about what to do. And then you see the investigator really pleased with himself, calling...
That was absolutely infuriating, I mean.
Yeah, calling the lawyer and then... the plan to feed him into the police the next day, which, you know, well, again, is violating.
Unconscionable to tell the police, okay, now, without me present, your lawyer being present, I want you to interrogate my client again. I have never, ever, ever heard of that happening in another case unless the defense attorney was actually working for the prosecution. I think this is exactly what was happening. What he was doing was he was trying to prepare a statement by his client that would help the prosecution in the prosecution of Steve Avery, mm-hmm. and that was it. He could not have been helping his own client at that point because he never even listened to his client in the first place.
He never met with him, I don't think, for a period of time.
Yeah, he didn't meet with him certainly for, in the first day or two. Mm-hmm. And at this
point, he was making those statements without even meeting his client.
It's just unconscionable. Mm-hmm. It was clearly not clearly not legal representation. And he should have been taken off the case long before. But when they had a hearing, when Brendan actually requested that he get a new lawyer, the judge simply questioned him. Again, this limited, you know, slow child in front of him. He says, why don't you want him as your attorney? And he said, and it took him a long time to get it out, but he said, because he thinks I'm guilty. Well, that isn't a good enough reason. And he just allowed him to go on and on and on and actually help get Brendan convicted.
This is the first time we're mentioning the judges who I had a big problem with these judges. I mean, what did you think of that?
Well, I mean, you know, judges are many of them elected and they work with these guys all the time. And, you know, this is a small community.
Right.
And I think that they're used to just seeing criminals come and go and they don't really give a damn about criminals. And they work with the lawyers all the time. Mm-hmm. And I think in this case, the decisions that the judges made were just very law enforcement oriented, which I don't mind if you have a guilty defendant there, if you have somebody who committed the crime. But the judges are supposed to be the arbiter of what is admissible and what isn't admissible, what is good conduct and what is not good conduct on the part of the investigators and the prosecutors. And I think in this case, they seem to have, and again, all I've seen is what was shown us in the documentary, but they seem to have bent over backwards to please the prosecution.
Mm-hmm. I think it was a, you know, an incredible decision in terms of, you know, how that confession was coerced for the judge to allow that, because without the confession, there wouldn't have been a case. And I think certainly Dassey making, you know, had written to the judge as well and said very clearly that he didn't do it. But when you twin it with the fact that, you know, all the previous of the defense lawyer not even meeting with his client, the fact that the investigator coerces, you know, his own, the investigator for his own defense counsel coerces the confession, you know, all of those things which only seem to come out later on. You know, I was surprised the judge didn't know that earlier, but some of those decisions are, you know, incredible. I also think, you know, going back to Avery, it was a very odd situation that it was the same judge who sat in on his appeal. I've certainly not seen that before,
I
was curious about that.
I mean, how likely is it for a judge to reverse
their own decision?
Unfortunately, I'm telling you, I've helped in some Innocence Project cases since I've retired, and that is not unusual, that the Court of Appeals sends it back to the same judge to make determinations about things that happened in front of that judge.
How can that be?
Our system is. It is not a perfect system. And unfortunately, I mean, there's a certain amount of meaning and merit to saying that once somebody is convicted, once somebody has a trial, that should stick. Because otherwise, we would be trying there's millions of people in jail. We'd be trying millions of trials every year, and the system would go bankrupt. And so there's a certain reason why they want to keep convicted criminals convicted. But there should be another
level.
There must
be some independence there.
There is, and that's what's going on now, or at least hopefully will go on now with the federal system, because they can actually review in this habeas petition, they can actually review whether or not Brendan Dassey and Steve Avery's constitutional rights were violated. And if they didn't get a fair trial, that would be a violation of their constitutional rights. So it's late. It's way down the road. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't be this late. And hopefully they'll still be able to have that opportunity to do. But if not, if the federal courts don't take it up, then unless some new outrageous information comes forward, they're going to be stuck in prison for a long, long time.
Just, certainly my first impressions, as I mentioned, of having watched the show was certainly leaning towards the fact that there was a conspiracy by a number of individuals. And, evidence was clearly planted. And I felt very much, based on what I had seen and heard, that Avery, again, had fallen foul of a number of people who were trying to set him up. And, indeed, they got the result that they were looking for. But then a number of things happened, which was when I was looking at other information, certainly the Brendan Dassey, the four-hour interview by the investigators, and I started to ask questions in a different way about what had been going on. And looking back at my original notes, some of the questions about the crime scene and things that just didn't fit. And then, of course, we had the Jodie disclosure about previous domestic abuse and coercion and violence at the hands of Avery. And, when I started to weigh up everything in terms of the balance of probability and certainly Brendan's account about what he first saw, I certainly feel that Stephen Avery had an unfair trial, and there were clear problems about how the evidence was adduced, how it was presented, how it was obtained, how Kratz had given the press conference and had given it was a prejudicial trial. He was found guilty even before the trial had happened. Right. But I certainly felt, on the balance of probability, weighing up all the things that I've seen and heard, and of course that is a caveat because there are other things. I haven't gone through every bit of detail in terms of what else was printed in terms of the information at the trial. But I certainly feel that, on the balance of probabilities, he probably did commit the murder of Teresa Halbach. Mm. She was last seen at his salvage yard, and there was very clear behaviour towards her, that not just her, but other women. And I felt that, given what Jodie had also said about his tendency towards fire setting, his anger and hatred towards women, the animal cruelty, his previous sexual violence towards women, him saying that, "You bitches, you're going to pay for this." It's coming from her disclosure, yes. Uh-huh. But I've worked with thousands of victims of domestic violence, and I felt her account was truthful and certainly gave a very different picture of Stephen Avery. And one I felt, I wondered whether that was lurking beneath the surface. So it's all the things together in terms of, how he was behaving. But I certainly think, having worked with many victims of domestic violence and stalking and what we call coercive control, that Jodie was being coercively controlled by him. And I felt that her account was genuine. Mm. So I believe that he did commit that murder, and he may have, on the balance of thinking that lightning will not strike twice, some of those decisions that we have been kicking around to today, thinking about, well, why did he do this, or how did that happen? Sometimes we are rationalizing things in the light of day, but we're not under the same pressures and conditions of offenders, that they make decisions that sometimes are in the blink of an eye. But I think certainly he went from sort of villain to hero in 18 years serving his time, and then he's standing on the shoulders of governors and senators and being held up as this, incredible person, this miscarriage of justice. And maybe he felt that, he was Teflon and bulletproof, and you know, certainly not being able to see Jodie that day, feeling that women owed him. I think there's a lot of contextual things that we talked about in the first podcast, that drawing it all together, that's where I am on the balance of probabilities. Mm-hmm. But of course, he never had a fair trial.
Right. Jim?
Yeah, and let me just start with Brendan Dassey, because I think mm-hmm. that's a much more clear-cut case. I think Brendan gave a false confession. It is the only reason why he was convicted, and I think that conviction should be vacated. I don't even think he should be given another trial. I think the conviction and a confession should just be vacated. Mm-hmm.
But how could he be given another trial when the whole world is talking about, you know, would it ever be a fair trial? I mean, I'm just throwing that out there because people were talking about, you know, him having a retrial, but how could it ever be?
Well, I think for Brendan, I don't think he should be retried. That's what I'm saying.
No.
I do not
right.
think
Absolutely.
He should be tried. I do believe that at the worst, Brendan Dassey was a witness to a crime committed by Steve Avery, and
after the fact,
he may have, yeah. after the fact, mm-hmm. helped him dispose of the body or help burn the body when it was on the fire already. Mm-hmm. Because, and that's, again, I'd have to know exactly what went on in that first interview of Brendan Dassey, but based on the information I have today, I think at worst, he was a witness to a crime and may have been an accessory after the fact. But being 16 years of age at the time and being in a position of being manipulated by his uncle, I think he was probably not criminally responsible and certainly would have been out of jail by the time he turned 21 if he was convicted as a youthful offender. But if we're talking about Steve Avery, it's a totally different situation. And I know a lot of people talk about, well, if there was a conspiracy, it would have to be this huge conspiracy and everybody would have had to have been part of it. And I think that's absolutely not true. I think in this case, there would only have to have been two or three people involved in a conspiracy. Mm-hmm. And I think Detective Lenk and Officer Colburn would have been major components of that. And I think separate from that, but also contributing to it, would have had to have been the edict of the chief of police. Mm-hmm. If the chief of police really wanted to get this guy, then I think, like happened in the first instance, then he, anybody under him would have tried to make sure they got this guy. But in this case, I think that they had a conflict of interest that they violated repeatedly. And that means that I think the key and the key fob should have been thrown out as evidence. I think the bullet that was found after Lenk had been back in that garage should have been thrown out as evidence. This is called contamination. And whether they did anything or not, they contaminated the scene by being there. Mm-hmm. So I think all that stuff should be excluded in a new trial. But I think that despite the fact that it would be difficult to get a jury that doesn't that hasn't formed an opinion about this, I think they should have the opportunity to have a new venue, a venue change, not be in their county or the county next door, but be somewhere all the way across state. And maybe it's impossible to find a jury that doesn't know enough about this case mm-hmm. or who hasn't been tainted by the information that that prosecutor gave out freely before the trial.
Right.
I think he has poisoned the jury pool, and that's why prosecutors do not do that kind of a public statement before a trial. During the investigation, it's just outrageous. So D.A. Kratz, I think, actually did more damage to this case than any of the investigators mm-hmm. did, and that's very unfortunate. But a lot of people also ask, but wait a minute. Steve Avery had just gotten out of jail a year or so before mm-hmm. this. His life was looking up. He had a new girlfriend, was going to get married. He was about to at least win some money from this lawsuit. Why would he do something like this? That's ridiculous. Everything was going well for him. Well, we all know in psychology and behavioral analysis that when you're under stress, you act to your extremes. You do extreme things. You don't necessarily think things through, mm-hmm. and you don't necessarily act according to your normal behavioral patterns. But what people don't know is that there are two types of stress. There's distress when negative things are happening to you, when you have so much piling up on you, you can act out in a very unusual manner. You can snap at people. You can be more violent. You can do things that you wouldn't normally do. But the other end of that spectrum is called eustress, euphoric stress. When things are going great for you, it's also a stressor. And when things have, when you've actually accomplished your goals or everything looks good, you can actually act in the same extreme way as if you were under extreme duress. And I believe this may be what happened here. You actually feel euphoric that you are bulletproof, that you don't, nothing is ever going to go wrong. And so, hey, I finally got exonerated from the first trial. 18 years I spent in prison, and I was building up this hatred and anger towards women, which if his fiance's statement is truthful, he said to her, bitches owe me. In general, women just owe me. And if his behavior, if you look at his behavior that was reported, that he was masturbating in public, that he was having sex in public, that he was going after women aggressively, that he would show up in his towel, those kinds of behaviors, if you take them to the extreme, if he believed that women owed him, then I believe he could have made a play for Teresa Hallback, which she rejected him, and he got very angry as a result of that.
Okay, so you think that he... Okay, so that's what you think it was. It wasn't a premeditated, I'm going to kill her.
I do not... No, I think I want to make I want to make a play for her. I don't think at all that he intended to kill her that day.
Oh, okay.
I think he would have tried to get her to have sex with him, and she would have rejected that and fought him, and he would have fought back and killed her as a result of that.
I mean, he clearly liked her because we know that he had called her three times that day and she had reported his behaviour to her boss. So, you know, that was exactly my view in terms of what had probably happened. Some of the time it's not murder in mind,
right. But
those things happen when somebody feels entitled and they've been rejected. And those circumstances, you know, then unfold. And I certainly think, you know, the way that the show was presented, I mean, one of the things for me is that, you know, the lens in which that story is told, there's a huge problem with. You know, so for Jim and I, the work that we do, obviously you want to look at all the information and evidence and analysis and conduct your own, investigation in many senses, asking questions, working with investigators, working with other people about, you know, and trying to get a very clear understanding of what's gone on. But that show is incredibly myopic in terms of the way that it presents the story, in that it helps the viewer make conclusions. And I found myself making those conclusions that they had set me up to make. And that's exactly why I made the notes that I did at the time, and why it's interesting that coming away from the show, looking at other information and evidence and exploring other possibilities that I'd written down, actually I'm falling on probably not a popular view, because obviously there's this huge groundswell of support for Stephen Avery, but actually Jim and I arrived at a similar conclusion independently. But it turned on the basis of information and evidence that wasn't shown in the actual show.
Laura and I look at behavior, and the behavior that we are looking at is not only what they report and what other witnesses report, but also the behavior that was exhibited by the person we're looking at, which is Steve Avery in this case. And we were both kind of a little put off by his lack of expressed anger when he got out of prison. We were both really concerned about, well, what are these reports that he was convicted for killing a cat, burning a cat in a fire?
Okay.
And I know you have some information about that you wanted to ask me about.
I don't know how groundbreaking this is. I just wanted to talk to you about this, and I know it's very gruesome, and I would never, ever excuse or condone any kind of animal cruelty. That said, I mean, for one thing, he wasn't the only one arrested for the cat, okay? He was a party to animal cruelty. So there was somebody else who was also involved in this.
Yeah, he said that he was playing around with the cat, throwing him over the fire.
Yeah, no, but another man was arrested with him. I mean,
yes,
it was, yeah.
It was, one other.
So, and what I'd asked you before, Jim, is about, you know, animal cruelty being a hallmark of being, turning into a killer. And I feel like in rural communities, you know, the thresholds that people deal with animals can be a little bit different. So if they're raising rabbits and they may kill them by hand, or they're, killing squirrels. But in this same county, 7 high schoolers were arrested not long after Stephen Avery's animal thing for doing what they call critter bashing, where they go out in the middle of the night, they try to get critters to come out, and they kill them with golf clubs and, you know, for
what's
fun.
What's a critter? Define critter for
critter,
me.
You know, would be feral cats, squirrels, rats, raccoons, possums, all the stuff that would be in this rural community, you know.
Okay, and you know, there is a difference when it's somebody's cat, that a domesticated mm-hmm. cat mm-hmm. And a feral animal. I think mm-hmm. there's a difference mm-hmm. there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. People hunt little mm-hmm. small animals mm-hmm. like that. Maybe not feral cats. I mean, I think that's a particularly... An extreme version of hunting. I don't know that people go out and hunt feral cats. They would hunt squirrels and muskrats
course.
And all mm-hmm. sorts of things mm-hmm. for food or mm-hmm. for just target practice, I guess, in certain places.
The only reason I bring this up is it's brought up again and again, the animal cruelty bit as being...
But all we're saying is when we're reverse engineering back mm-hmm, from the mm-hmm. kind of crime that we have here.
Right.
And we would expect this crime to have been committed by somebody who has some level of criminal sophistication, mm-hmm. but not a high level of intelligence. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Somebody who has a history of violence toward women, acting out sexually, somebody who may have a history of fire setting and enuresis and cruelty to animals. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm, we look back and mm-hmm, we say, mm-hmm. all right, let's look at the suspect pool. Who has these things? And if he does, then... we can say that his behavior is consistent with the end result. There are other people that also have things mm-hmm. like that as well, mm-hmm. but do they have all of them? Mm-hmm. And did they call her up that day? And were they the last person seen with them? And was there...
I would posit respectfully that yes, there were other males on that property who have just as many...
But none of their blood was found in the
correct,
car.
But you've already X'd out all that. Said that we've X'd out some of this evidence that you feel might have been planted or...
Oh, not the blood. I never said that the blood was planted. No, what I said was that if they can develop a test that mm-hmm. would show the minutest level of EDTA in a blood sample, mm-hmm. then I think those other three blood samples should be tested and determine whether there's any trace of it at all. And I think that would be determinative. Right now, you can't throw it out. I mean, it's there.
Okay.
And on top of that, his DNA is under the hood latch.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's another place that's another type of evidence. It's his mm-hmm. skin cells that mm-hmm. were there. What possible reason could they be there? They weren't in a test tube in the police lab. They weren't in the file. How did they collect his skin cells and put them there?
And we're sure that it was a properly handled test.
In and that case, there was no indication that the sample was corrupted.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, anyway, there is forensic evidence there, and, mm-hmm. and I think the most damning of which is the multiplicity of bones in his fire pit behind his house. I don't believe in any way, shape, or form that the police killed her
or
found her body somewhere else and dumped it there.
No, that's not even...
So the only way that it could be that he didn't do it is if somebody else who lived there, who was able to burn a body for a number of hours without anybody else knowing it, behind his house on a day when he was home and when he was actually standing by a fire. It's just, I think the probability mm-hmm. of somebody else being able to do that and plant that evidence at that time is minuscule to be almost non-existent.
And it's that balance of probabilities. Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't think we should have what is called an epistemic imbalance. I know that's a big word.
Oh, my goodness.
But leaning towards one thing on its own. And you've kind of centered around, you know, the animal abuse.
Oh,
but
I
still want to weigh in again on that mm-hmm. because we are talking about a family cat and we are talking about him pouring gasoline mm-hmm. with another on a family cat mm-hmm. and setting it alight and then throwing it on the bonfire.
No, of course.
Now, when people do things like that, you know, yes, you can get young boys who are messing around because it is predominantly boys who do that kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
You know, experimenting in inverted commas.
Mm-hmm.
But it does give us a clear indicator that all is not well.
Mm-hmm.
Some may grow out of that.
Right.
But actually, what it does tell us is that those who harm animals are more likely to go on to harm human beings.
Right.
So as Jim said, it's just an indicator. It's something that, you know, if you heard about people doing that, no matter where they are in the country or where they are in the world, there is a clear problem going on and you would want to try and get into some form of early intervention, you know, whatever that might be. But of course, in some places it can be normed out, but it is a family cat and it's not about going out hunting or doing something for purpose or, you know, messing around. And even though there is one other person involved, that does not take away the fact.
Absolutely. I guess I was just asking if, you know, if there's behavior where somebody's in private and killing an animal, mutilating it time after time in secret and private, and then that's discovered,
it's
as opposed
normally,
to it being like a public,
no,
wilding.
No, it's not normally in secret or public. And the other thing I just want to make clear is that there is a link to domestic abuse as well.
Sure.
When there's animal cruelty. Now, in the UK, and there's a lot of research going back to the 70s, you know, and predates that even, about people who harm animals, you know, go on to harm human beings. And, you know, it can be used as a control mechanism of harming cats or pets in the family home or getting a clear message to the adult in that household. You know, we've had dogs with their throats slit being put in baths for when, you know, the female comes home. God. There's a very clear message to them being sent that you're next. And I've actually created a risk assessment tool around, you know, that includes around domestic violence, but includes that as one of the high risk factors. So it is an important thing in research that tells us about, you know, how or sometimes lack of empathy. And of course, they did put that right up front in the show as sort of a disclaimer of we're putting everything out there, warts
and
all.
How he described it. He described it not that he poured lighter fluid on or some accelerant on the cat and threw it in the fire, but that they were tossing it back and forth and it accidentally fell into the
yes.
fire.
Yes, and you read my mind on that, Jim, because that's what I was just about to say. It's about his account at the start up of the show that this was just, he was tossing this cat across this fire and it falls into it, which is very different to what actually happened. So that's another thing that raises an eyebrow.
Sure.
That you start to look for things that confirm or deny. And of course, you know, the show, as they claim, is not about finding guilt or innocent. It's about presenting the facts and the evidence. But what they have done is put it through a very myopic lens, which, you know, for our work, Jim and I, we don't look at forming a conclusion of the who. You just look at all the information, the evidence and the facts.
The why and the how will lead you to who. And what we try to do is withhold judgment till the very end. And that was very difficult with this documentary because, as Laura said, they really were trying to corral everybody's thoughts and emotions one direction.
Wow.
And you may not see that because you haven't actually investigated thousands of cases over the last 30 years as Laura and I have.
I'm sure, but I have seen a lot of documentaries and I have worked on quite a few. And but, I know that this, you know, stories unfold for filmmakers the way they do. And
it's about creating entertainment.
Are you kidding me? Are you telling me that documentarians don't have a script?
Aren't they
not entertainment?
They are. And sometimes they're very helpful, like in Thin Blue Line.
Absolutely.
They're all different kinds of documentaries. But to think that I don't feel that they were trying to... I think they were telling a very compelling story in an amazing way.
So what we do, we're able to look past whatever the forensic evidence is and whatever the legalities of it and look just... We concentrate on the behavior. And then that is explained or contradicted by whatever the physical evidence is. In this case... We both felt very compelled emotionally in one direction by the documentary. That's why we're saying that we felt it was manipulating us in that area. But at the same time, we were reserving judgment. We were holding back to find out more information. Unfortunately, we found that Brendan Dassey was manipulated into a false confession. That is an absolute miscarriage of justice and should be undone as quickly as possible.
Right.
At the same time, we felt... that Steve Avery was not given a fair trial. And no matter what evidence we have found against him, that we feel makes him guilty of this underlying crime, we believe wholeheartedly he should get another trial because he did not have an unbiased jury. That jury was definitely poisoned by the district attorney. Period.
Major problem. Guilty before the trial. And so it just cannot stand on its own, no matter what our thoughts and conclusions are thereafter.
Did you have any reaction when the defense attorney mentioned the polling, the jury, that there were seven people that were going to find him not guilty and two were undecided and three were guilty. I mean, does that tell you that at the end of the day, the case wasn't
Let me tell you something about criminal law. They're not supposed to do a poll when they just go in there. They're supposed to begin deliberating. They are never supposed to take a poll when they just get in there.
That I was on my jury.
Absolutely wrong. The judge is supposed to instruct them that deliberations begins now. Do not go in there with any predeterminations. Actually, talk about the evidence now. Talk about the charges, and your deliberations start from here forward. It's totally irrelevant what people thought when they go in. But that's just one point. The fact that they that people go one way or the other when they're in there, it's a human thing. The fact that the judge tells them not to consider that is absolutely absolutely bullshit. But that's the way our system works. It's not the best system. It's not the perfect system, but it may be the best system.
I guess that's another important point, actually, Jim, isn't it? You know, everybody's human, you know, and we forget that part. We talk about systems and processes in a very clinical way, but then you get the human being element, the emotional element, everything else that, that comes into it. That, you know, of course, no system will ever be perfect. And, you know, any system, we've talked a lot about the police officers and what they did here and the prosecutors and things that they shouldn't have done. But there's always good and bad. And, you know, in any walk of life, there's always going to be good and bad. And I think the really important things to take away from this also about the learning, you know, how do you change the system? How do you improve it? How do you make it better so that we don't keep seeing these huge injustices, you know, and these miscarriages of justice where people, you know, 18 years spending that time inside, you know, and the whole show is about making a murderer. Did it turn him into that person? You know, so it's actually about the learning of how we get better.
You know, checks and balances that need to
absolutely.
Be put in.
And I wish they had actually gone through with that thought, because I do believe that that is what they're trying to apply by the name of the series. And I don't know when they decided to call it that, but I do believe that is what is implied. And it may very well be true to a certain extent. And as I've explained before, I don't think they could have just taken anybody and turned him or her into a murderer, but somebody who had a predisposition to being violent towards women, acting out sexually aggressively and so forth, cruelty to animals and all that kind of stuff. You put him in prison wrongfully for 18 years, you're going to turn that guy into a twisted individual. And that's why we expected to see some sort of behavior to that extent when he came out. We didn't
particularly as he'd pulled a gun on his cousin before that, on just a rumour. And that's why I said talked about the incongruence, you know, of how he behaved thereafter. So I think there's a huge amount of learning from this. It's a much bigger picture.
And I know we're about to wrap it up. Do you want to know what I think?
Yeah,
Go ahead. Yeah, absolutely. Weigh in.
I think he's guilty. I think he's innocent. I don't know. But what I do feel is an, you know, not part of law enforcement, not an expert, I just can't imagine somebody who's grown up in this community who's, you know, the police have been up his kazoo for his whole life, coming back and thinking that he could get away with hiding the body, the this, the that, on the property right where, you know, I just can't imagine that. If, you know, a cat goes missing in that county, let's go to Steve Avery. I mean, he knows he's the number one suspect, that they will do anything to...
To get it.
And I just can't imagine somebody who's been incarcerated, who's been through the system, would want anything to do. I mean, I completely hear, you know, what you're saying about you stress, and that makes sense. But on my gut level, I just can't imagine.
Right. And what you should focus on more, I think, is the fact that he didn't plan to do this.
Yeah, that's something I hadn't
thought of. It's not something he'd want to do, but
It
is something that he would be forced to do. Once he had taken that step and tried to approach her sexually and she rebuffed him and he tried to force himself on her. And I think that point, it was a fait accompli.
Yeah.
He was not going to take no for an answer. She was not going to submit to that. And he had to kill her to get what he wanted.
Yeah.
And I think that is why he then had to get rid of the body. And I still think that it's thriftiness that kept that car on that lot, not anything else.
And he operates on, you know, one or two gears. I remember that. You know, why, for me, that's what I was remembering the whole way through.
He pulls a gun. Too.
Yeah, he had a very, very low IQ. He pulls a gun on someone because she spread a rumor about him, you know, and his defense attorney at that time was talking about the fact that he operates on one or two gears. That's his coping mechanism. That's how he behaves and his entitlement. You know, and I think that rejection happened. Mm-hmm. He had set his sights on her. I don't think there was murder in mind, but that's what unfolded. And then he has to get rid of as much of the evidence as he can.
Well, you guys, this has been amazing conversation.
Yeah.
And I really, you know, you changed my mind, Jimmy, I got to tell you. Well, I never thought of that. And I think it's really interesting. Anyway, this has been a fascinating conversation. Thank you both.
And I want to thank you, Lisa, for helping us out with this and giving us those really important insights that we may not see anymore because we're so focused on behavior. But Laura and I have really enjoyed this. I've enjoyed having you here, Laura. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And I hope you look forward to our next case that we're going to dissect on Real Crime Profile.
Well, there's a whole bunch of cases that I've been looking at that I want to talk to you guys about, and we'll be back shortly. You can follow us at Real Crime Profile without the E at the end. So it's all one word, at RealCrimeProfil.
And where can people find you, Jim?
I'm at jimclementi.com and at Jim Clementi on Twitter. And my guests today are Laura Richards.
And you can find me on Twitter at LauraRichards99 and www.laurarichards.co.uk.
And Lisa Zambetti.
And you can't find me anywhere, but you can tune into Criminal Minds on CBS Wednesdays at
9 o'clock. Thank you so much for listening in. This is Jim Clementi at Real Crime Profile with Laura Richards and Lisa Zambetti.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan, engineered by Jacob Moose Molin. Music is composed and performed by Simba Sumba. Logo art by Rob Cohen. Real Crime Profile is produced and recorded at Empire Studios LA by XG Productions.